This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau remains in power as his main rival concedes defeat in Monday's early elections, but his Liberal Party falls short of a majority win. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urges international action to avert what he calls climate catastrophe. And France denounces the United States' lack of consultation over a submarine pact with Australia after the EU blamed Washington for ignoring the Canberra-Paris deal. Thank you for joining us. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party is projected to win the country's hotly contested elections for the lower house of parliament. According to TV projections, the Liberals are leading in 155 electoral districts nationally. However, they look set to fall short of the 170 seats needed to hold a majority at the lower house of parliament. Canada's opposition Conservatives have already conceded defeat in the elections. Prime Minister Trudeau called the vote 2 years early in the hope of winning the majority he lost in the 2019 elections. Final results are still days away, with the pandemic and a delay in counting mail-in votes hampering the process. Author and commentator Yves Zengler says the election was a failed bet for Trudeau as his party falls short of a majority win. Zengler also believes any change in government would not have brought any real change in Canada's policy.
Basically, Trudeau wanted a majority. He had a minority government. He wanted a majority. He thought that this was his best chance to do that due to a whole series of factors with regards to upcoming elections at the provincial and municipal levels. And basically, what he got was exactly what he had beforehand. The political parties are in agreement on spending over $100 billion on new naval vessels and fighter jets. The political parties are kind of slightly varying amounts of wanting to get tough on China. You know, the Trudeau government promised to restart diplomatic relations with Iran. that were ended by the previous conservative government. They promised that back in 2015. They haven't moved forward on that. None of the opposition parties criticized the Liberals for that. Foreign policy was little discussed during the election, and the differences between the different parties is very minimal. Now, the Conservatives, lost the second party in the country. They are even more extreme. They wanted to move Canada's embassy to Jerusalem. They wanted to, get even more tough on Iran, even more tough on China. So it's good that they didn't win. The Liberals are maybe slightly better, a slightly less bad foreign policy than the Conservatives. But really, the difference between the five parties on relations to the rest of the world is unfortunately very minimal.
The Mexican president calls on his U.S. counterpart to act immediately to invest in Central America to stem the flow of migrants.
If this action were applied immediately in Guatemala, Honduras, and Salvador, 90,000 people could be kept in their countries of origin of all those who immigrate due to lack of work.
Obrador further said that the migration phenomenon must be addressed with a completely new approach. He warned that the use of containment measures is not enough to deal with migrants. His remarks followed reports that migrants were being whipped along the U.S.-Mexico border. The migrants were apparently Haitians and were seeking asylum in the United States when they were encountered by Texas Border Patrol. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the use of whips against migrants was unacceptable.
There are photographs and reports of border agents on horseback using what appear to be whips on Haitian migrants. Does the administration view that as an appropriate tactic? Can you speak to that? There are people who are upset about it.
Yeah, understandably so. I have seen some of the footage. I don't have the full context. I can't imagine what context would make that appropriate, but I don't have additional details. And certainly, I don't have additional context. April, I don't think anyone seeing that footage would think it was acceptable or appropriate.
Psaki, however, declined to say what consequences there should be for the actions of Border Patrol. She said the images were, quote, horrible to watch, but added more information was needed before she could comment further. Thousands of migrants, majority of them from Haiti, have arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border, fleeing natural disasters and political unrest in their countries. Most of them live in a squalid encampment under an overpass bridge in Del Rio, Texas. U.S. officials started to deport the migrants on Saturday, a move that has been criticized by immigrant advocacy groups and some Democrats. Political commentator John Parker says the treatment of Haitian migrants by the U.S. Border Patrol is reminiscent of the country's dark history of slavery.
It's just unimaginable. I don't know of any time when I've seen there's been so many horrible things done against immigrants by the United States Border Patrol, including murder and things like that. But the whipping, I've never seen that being done. And I don't think it's any accident that these are very dark-skinned black people that are being whipped. And it really makes you think about the history of slavery in this country. This is a huge human rights crisis that's going on. And these are people that are not doing anything basically illegal. They're under Title 14. They're supposed to be allowed to seek asylum when their lives are being threatened. And unfortunately, the Donald Trump, the racist Trump, denied them the right to use that Title 14. And Biden came into office, and instead of which he said he was going to do, instead of overturning that and allowing the human rights of the people seeking asylum to happen, he's continued it. And it's under his administration
right.
that these border patrol people are using whips. He ought to be ashamed of himself.
The UN Secretary General has called for international action to avert what he describes as a climate catastrophe.
My message this morning and to the Conference of Parties in November is that we need decisive action now to avert climate catastrophe. And for that, we need solidarity. Saving these and future generations is a common responsibility. And I am fully ready to support Prime Minister.
Guterres also warned that with the current carbon emission levels, the world is on track to witness a 2.7 degrees Celsius annual warming. That's almost double the temperature needed to avoid irreversible disasters, as outlined in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. The UN chief called on the world's richer nations to deliver on their commitments toward a $100 billion per year climate fund to help developing countries deal with climate change. He made the remarks during a meeting with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. The discussions were held ahead of a two-week climate summit, which will be hosted by the United Kingdom starting from October the 31st. The European Union has sided with France in a row over Australia's ditching a multi-billion dollar submarine deal with Paris in favor of an alternative pact with the US and the UK. European Council Chief Charles Michel accused Washington of a, quote, lack of loyalty, saying allies needed to be sure of transparency and trust. Michel said the move would reinforce European efforts to build their own defense capacity. Separately, the President of the European Commission said the treatment France received is unacceptable. She said there are a lot of open questions in the secret pact Australia made with Britain and the U.S. before scrapping the deal with France. The European Commission says trade talks between the EU and Australia might be derailed by the diplomatic crisis between Paris and Canberra.
The issue centers around a contract signed 5 years ago worth up to 50 billion euro for France to build 12 submarines for Australia. Out of the blue, Paris found out a few days ago that the deal is off. France is furious, and so too is the EU. Talks on a new trade deal between the 27-nation bloc and Australia took place in June and were due to resume in October. We're told that's now in doubt.
We are analysing the impact of the AUKUS announcement and what this impact could be on this schedule.
AUKUS is a new security deal signed between the US, Britain and Australia. It means France's submarines are no longer required. The country's foreign minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, says it's a stab in the back from allies.
There will be consequences. Consequences, of course, for the French relationship with the US, with Australia, with the UK, but that also implies there will be consequences for the relationship between the EU and these countries.
Senior EU ministers will discuss their response to the diplomatic crisis in the early hours of Tuesday morning, Brussels time.
There will be a meeting of EU 27 foreign ministers chaired by HMVP Borrell in New York on the margins of the UN General Assembly.
Paris has already withdrawn its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. The AUKUS nuclear submarines will use the latest undersea technologies in the South China Sea. Beijing says the move smacks of Cold War mentality. North Korea warns it could trigger a nuclear arms race. Political analysts are suggesting Australia and Britain need to be very circumspect when dealing with the US. They point to all the international agreements Trump pulled the plug on. Also, Biden indicated he would rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. That still hasn't happened. And look at the impact of US unilateral decisions with respect to Afghanistan. Many are asking, can Washington really be trusted? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran has called on the International Atomic Energy Agency to refrain from making politically motivated decisions.
Iran has always cooperated with the IAEA. The agency, in return, should avoid making politically motivated decisions, remain impartial and independent, and also maintain its professional conduct.
Mohammad Islami was addressing the IAEA's 65th General Conference. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran met with IAEA chief Rafael Grossi and slammed Israel's, quote, terrorist attacks against his country's nuclear sites and the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Islami denounced the inaction of the United Nations and the IAEA on such measures. Further, in his remarks, the official touched on the sanctions the U.S. reimposed on Iran following Washington's unilateral pullout from the 2015 nuclear deal. Islami demanded that Washington remove the bans in a verifiable manner.
It is time the United States rectified its wrong policies and removed all sanctions in action. and in an efficient and verifiable manner.
The Iranian official said the U.S. has no way but to abandon its cult addiction to sanctions. Eslami highlighted the failure of the so-called maximum pressure campaign Washington launched against Tehran following its 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. He said Tehran seeks result-oriented talks with the aim of removing unfair sanctions. Iran has held several rounds of talks with the remaining parties to the nuclear deal to revive it and pave the way for the removal of U.S. sanctions. But the negotiations remain stalled due to what Tehran calls the excessive demands of Washington and its allies. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has destroyed four bases of anti-Iran terror groups operating across the border in northern Iraq. An IRGC commander said the operation was carried out using combat drones and smart artillery shells. The commander added that anti-Iran groups have been organized and backed by hostile and foreign countries, even some Arab nations in northern Iraq. The IRGC has conducted a series of raids against Iraq-based terrorists over the past 2 weeks. The new operation comes shortly after the chief of staff of Iran's armed forces warned of tough actions if terrorists continue their attacks on Iranians. Iraq's northern region has been used for a long time by terror outfits, such as the Kurdistan Workers' Party and its offshoot, Pajak, to launch sporadic attacks on Iran's western border areas. Muslims are descending on Iraq's holy city of Karbala ahead of the day of Arba'in. The pilgrims will join the annual gathering that marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. This year, Arba'in falls on September the 28th. The event drew millions of people in the past years, but the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign visitors since last year due to the pandemic. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred in an unequal battle with troops of the tyrant ruler of their time over 13 centuries ago. The battle, known as the Ashura event, is one of the most important religious occasions marked by Muslims. U.S. stocks have tumbled again amid investors' worries that troubles in China's property market could trigger a broader sell-off across all financial markets. At the end of trading on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 2%, which was its steepest loss since July. The broad-based S&P 500 and the Nasdaq Composite also slid at similar pace on Monday, recording their largest one-day decline since May. The plunge was largely linked to Asian markets, where Hong Kong stock fell up to 19% amid default fears. The fall in shares of China's second biggest developer, Evergrande, dragged the Hang Seng Index down to its lowest point for nearly a year. The Russian president says the high voter turnout in recent parliamentary polls means the people are feeling a greater responsibility toward electing their representatives.
The turnout was more than 51%. This is much more than some 47 on the previous election. It shows that people take seriously the formation of the highest representative agency of state power, of the state Duma.
Putin was responding to opposition parties' allegations of a large-scale vote rigging during a virtual meeting with Ella Pamfilova, the head of Russia's election commission. Pamfilova, for her part, said the commission recorded a high number of cyber attacks during the 3 days of voting. She, however, hailed the Russian electoral system as one of the most transparent in the world. Near final results show the ruling United Russia Party has won the election with nearly 50% of the ballots. Its nearest rival, the Communist Party, secured less than 19% of the votes. That's your world news for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. Give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
Britain plays an outsized role in the conflict in Yemen. A 2018 paper found that an estimated 7,000 employees of UK contractor companies, civil servants, and temporarily deployed military personnel were currently aiding Saudi forces in their attack on their country. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Main Press News. This article is published under the heading, British soldier arrested for protesting against Yemen war and arms support for Saudi Arabia. Stay tuned for more. The war in Afghanistan appears to be ended, but Western atrocities in the West Asia region continue, with the 20-year-old so-called war on terror estimated to have displaced over 37 million people globally. One particularly noteworthy example is the onslaught in Yemen driving the country to become the world's worst humanitarian crisis, in the opinion of the United Nations. Currently, more than half the country, about 14 million people, are considered to be at risk of starvation. While the Saudis may be doing the majority of the fighting, they are being armed, trained, aided, and supported by the United States, Great Britain, and other Western nations, profiting from the suffering. One man who knows more than most about this is Ahmad al-Babati. Ahmad was a lance corporal in the British Army until last August, where he staged a public protest in London, demonstrating against British complicity in the violence. Explaining his decision, he said, "I joined the Army in 2017 and took an oath to protect and serve this country, not to be part of a corrupt government that continues to arm and support terrorism. What made this decision so easy for me and why I choose to sacrifice a lot of things, including possibly my freedom, is the simple fact that I myself, as somebody who was born in Yemen, could have easily fallen victim to one of those airstrikes or died from hunger. I have seen too much not to speak about, and I'd rather sleep peacefully in a cell than stay silent for a paycheck," unquote. Born in Yemen, but growing up in the industrial city of Sheffield in the north of England, al-Babati told Low Key that he naively believed that the army would pay him to travel the globe and that the organization he was joining was a pro-Muslim one. However, he soon found that it was actually filled with fascists who support far-right provocateurs like Tommy Robinson or Nigel Farage. Part of his duties to his faith, al-Babati began collecting money and sending food parcels to people in his birth country. However, he soon began receiving feedback from recipients that, while grateful, they would rather people from the United Kingdom stop participating in the ongoing slaughter than send aid. It was at that point that he began seriously examining his own life and how he was a part of the war machine. He told Loki, "I looked in depth at what the British involvement was, and I felt like a hypocrite because I was helping these Yemeni people out in terms of giving them aid to live by. But at the same time, I was serving the same government that was putting them there in a situation of famine in the first place," unquote. In August of last year, al-Babati staged a protest outside the Ministry of Defense in London. He was quickly detained and expected the worst. However, his actions received enough attention and public sympathy that he was not treated harshly by his superiors. He said, "It is thanks to the people who were protesting on my behalf that the charges were dropped. Britain plays an outsized role in the conflict in Yemen." A 2018 paper found that an estimated 7,000 employees of UK contractor companies, civil servants, and temporarily deployed military personnel were currently aiding Saudi forces in their attack on the country. Serving Saudi Arabia is big business in the UK. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, the kingdom is by far Britain's most important arms customer, responsible for 49% of all international weapons purchases. In this free-flowing conversation, Low Key and al-Babati discuss Britain's role in the world. Al-Babati said, whether it is Yemen, Afghanistan, or Palestine, it seems like we are at the center of the problems happening around the world. And the reason for that is that we benefit from it. We profit from it. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Stream.
Washington and its delegates in Lebanon, the last of whom was a delegation of the U.S. Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, know that Hezbollah's decision is a major breach of the U.S. undeclared sanctions against Lebanon and a major break of the embargo imposed on adopting alternatives that strictly fall within the American-approved basket of options. However, the Americans view the situation from another angle and are more attached to their grand project, especially to Lebanon, which is adjacent to occupied Palestine, and thus to Israel's higher interests. The Americans see that Sayyid Nasrallah's last decision has moved Hezbollah from a position of steadfastness in the face of U.S. siege policies and pressures to a position of direct confrontation. And in this position, the Americans take into account the resistance's intention and willingness to reach far in this confrontation. Meanwhile, this transition for Washington means that its tools in Lebanon, whether traditional or even civil society institutions, better known as NGOs, are at stake. Neither are they able to confront the resistance in its decision to confront the American blockade, nor are they able to support it, which deepens the predicament they fell into since Sayyid Nasrallah announced in his speech on the 10th of Muharram the launch of the first fuel ships to break the siege of Lebanon. Hezbollah's decision re-emphasized the importance of Syria in relation to Lebanon, as well as to the axis of resistance. This pushed the U.S. administration through its ambassador in Beirut to hastily announce its intention and readiness to lift part of its sanctions and siege on Syria imposed under the Caesars Act to open the way for electricity and gas from Jordan and Egypt to Lebanon through Syrian territories, obliging an American affirmation of Syria's value and position in relation to Lebanon. The choice of the United States to accept competition with Hezbollah instead of confronting it comes at a historic moment for it in light of its ongoing defeat in Afghanistan, while the Naftali Bennett government in occupied Palestine is left with nothing but trouble after the American withdrawal by activating its aggression raids against Syria. This new situation makes it imperative for the Lebanese state to open up to Syria and provides it with the appropriate opportunity to do so. On the Lebanese side, Hezbollah's major decision puts any future government in front of a fait accompli that will not be able to skip. The designated Prime Minister Najib Mikati tried to gain more time to bypass the arrival of fuel ships. However, the fact that the ships arrived in Syria instead of Lebanon can be considered a kind of a settlement that preserves the faces of the Lebanese state and its institutions, as well as the facts created by the decision in terms of prompting the U.S. administration to stand in line to try to solve Lebanon's economic crisis. Hezbollah has always dealt with great caution with the internal situation in order to avoid conflict with its opponents and allies alike. Today, however, Hezbollah stands at the center of a new equation of confrontation with the United States directly. Hezbollah knows that this battle is inseparable from the main battle related to preserving the resistance, its role, legitimacy, and position, even if it differs in form. Today, however, Hezbollah is preparing for the arrival of the first Iranian ship loaded with petroleum products to declare the fifth victory this time against U.S. hegemony. After the liberation in 2000 and the July 2006 victory against Israel, the Arsal victory against Takfiri terrorists in 2017, and the victory against Western and Wahhabi-funded terrorists inside Syria. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Iranian ship loaded with fuel, which Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah announced on the 10th day of Muharram that it set off from Iran and that its final cargo destination will be Lebanon, entered Syrian territorial waters last week. According to the Al-Akhbar Lebanese Daily, the cargo of the ship will be transported by tankers from Syria to Lebanon after unloading it at the Syrian port of Banias. Now, Al-Akhbar newspaper also stated that the part of the ship's cargo will be donated by Hezbollah to government hospitals and care homes. Now, experts believe that this move will actually increase Hezbollah's popularity both inside and outside Lebanon for taking the initiative to save the Lebanese people from hardships while also defending the country's sovereignty and dignity. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut right here is Dr. Tim Anderson, academic, author, and general coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance in Australia. Dr. Tim, thank you for being with us in Beirut. Now, practically, the U.S. does not care about the welfare of the Lebanese people. They only concern about weakening Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance. If stability achieves this kind of weakening, they will go with stability. If actual chaos achieves this, they will go with chaos. They don't care. But now a convoy of Iranian fuel ship has been ordered by Hezbollah to arrive to Lebanon through Syria, which is breaking both internal monopoly and American hegemony and sanctions against both Lebanon and Syria at the same time. How do you think the U.S. will react to this, or actually is reacting right now to this?
Well, thank you. The first reaction is, of course, they've rapidly tried to mobilize some alternative energy streams. Whether that's going to materialize in the near future is not clear, but that was to do with the idea of getting some energy from Jordan and from Egypt going through Syria. So that was the first stage. Apart from that, I think it's very difficult for the US to do things openly. They really want to preserve the image of themselves as a savior of the region, and that's why it's a game of trying to put the blame on the resistance and trying to avoid the blame themselves. So they have to move quite carefully in the current circumstances, because everyone in this country knows the problem with fuel, and everyone is going to welcome any move to break that blockade.
Well, including breaking the U.S. being itself breaking its own law against Syria. How do you think about that?
Well, the U.S. law, which we should not call sanctions, by the way, they're unilateral coercive measures. They're against Lebanon and against Syria and against Iran, but there have always been these type of exceptions where, through the grace and favor of the Secretary of the Treasury in the U.S., they can grant exemptions to people, particularly for the third-party sanctions, which are the things that are most operative here there. So the U.S. can manipulate these sorts of rules as it suits, as we know, and really it'll do it to try and maintain its image in the region, which is, of course, suffering greatly for a range of reasons at the moment.
Well, Iran has proved to be a great friend and ally to all countries in the region, but specifically here, Syria and Lebanon, which fall under the banner of the Axis of Resistance in West Asia. But this time, the Iranian move not only positively affected Lebanon, but also it affected Syria, which saw the first visit by an official Lebanese delegation from the government, despite the fact it's the resigning government here, but still it's the official delegation, after this Iranian ship also was announced. What made the U.S. allow those government officials to finally visit Damascus? And I'm saying allow because one of the ministers actually said that. He said the U.S. allowed us to do this. What made them allow them to do this and break this Caesar's Act against, basically it was against anyone who deals with the Syrian government. And now they are pushing the Lebanese government to go deal with the Syrian government.
Yes, it's a peculiar word which comes up from time to time, allow, isn't it? And it would be very strange in any other country if we spoke of the government getting permission from some government on the other side of the world to do things, to talk to their neighbours in particular. And of course, that's the rub here, that Lebanon has only one land trading border, and that is with Syria. So therefore, the alternative options that were proposed by the US representative here and her masters were that these potential energy sources, if they are to materialise, would have to come in some way through Syria. So therefore, I think that's why the US granted permission to the representatives of the Lebanese government to visit their neighbour.
Yeah, might I remind or maybe give an info to our audience that half, if not more than half, the ministers of this government and potentially the upcoming government as well already have U.S. passports. So by all means, this is a chaotic scene in Lebanon. But all that the Biden administration today wants from Lebanon is to inflict the greatest possible harm against Hezbollah. And I'm not saying this, it's the Biden administration who keeps saying this at every time and every chance they get. And it never asks or cares about the fate or the future of the Lebanese people, even about the fate and the future of its own assets and supposed to be allies in Lebanon, whether it's political parties, associations, NGOs, you name it. However, Hezbollah's move restored a lot of popularity amongst amongst different areas in Lebanon where they are usually considered anti-resistance areas. People started saying, no, we accept what Hezbollah is doing. That broke a lot of the U.S. plans inside of Lebanon. Would that push the U.S. to end Lebanon's security stability, despite the fact that it's not really good right now, the security, but it's still holding it together?
Well, it's already been undermining Lebanon's security for some time. It's not going to be happy with the fact that the solutions to a lot of Lebanon's problems are going to be better relations with their neighbours. This is not rocket science, but unfortunately it's something that the big powers have done from the beginning, haven't they? They divided the Levant up into different groups. They divided Lebanon into different confessional groups and so on. They created these sorts of systems, and they specialise in dividing people and keeping them fragmented and weak. And of course, the reverse applies, that the solutions for stability and for energy security, amongst other things, have to be greater cooperation, particularly with neighbours.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will continue talking about this matter and about the role of the U.S. in stopping a lot of developing plans and a lot of positive plans for Lebanon since actually before the civil war and later on after this plague. Please stay tuned. We will continue talking to Dr. Tim Anderson about the matter of the Iranian fuel ships going and on its way to Beirut.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, In this weekly program, Marwo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Now, in a statement before leaving the Lebanese capital, Beirut, the Democratic senator in the U.S. Congress, Richard Blumenthal, considered that Hezbollah is a rampant cancer that must be eradicated only because the resistance decided to ask its allies for help to rid Lebanon from the fuel crisis. Yes, you heard that right. A foreign member of Congress of a country 10,000 kilometers away from my country had the audacity not only to comment on Lebanese internal affairs, but also made sure to attack the largest and most powerful political bloc and resistance faction in the region. In a statement from Beirut International Airport, Blumenthal then stressed that Lebanon should not rely on Iran to solve its crisis, especially via the fuel ship, stressing that the U.S. administration is actively working to solve the fuel crisis. Yeah, sure. Iranian fuel ships bound for Lebanon exposes U.S. role in fuel crisis in this following report.
At every political pit stop in Lebanon, the old problem of securing electricity and energy in the country resurfaces. Several times, this crisis came close to taking the path to a solution before it collided with various obstacles, setting back the clock by years or even decades. This allowed the nurture of a system that constitutes one of the biggest sources of financial waste, whether for the public treasury or for the foreign currency reserves of the Lebanese Central Bank. Years of incompetence and corruption have brought the energy sector to what it is today, and for the most part, it was intended either to secure the sustainability of the profits of owners of the most expensive private generators that illegally filled the hours of power outage of the state-provided electricity, or in order to block the way for people working to solve the problem so that said people do not appear alone as saviors while others were failures. However, little does the world knows about the role of the United States of America in bringing the situation of the electricity sector in Lebanon to its current terrible state. It is, of course, not a conspiracy theory, as many people claim when they hear the smallest word criticizing their favorite empire. The role of the United States in the electricity crisis starts from the top of the pyramid, that is, from the nature of its system as well as the Lebanese economic system, which is a microcosm of its American counterpart, despite the nature of the relationship between both countries, which can be described as commander-slash-subordinate one. The pillars of the capitalist system depend on making profits, regardless of the environmental, social, economic, health, and human costs, as well as on the exploitation of resources, especially those belonging to weak countries, and the exclusion of everything that might affect the interest of large merchants, large companies, financiers, and the deep state in America. This explains the dependence of the greater part of the world to this day on non-renewable energy, such as oil, gas, coal, etc., to provide electricity and bear its high costs on the planet and its inhabitants, whether it is health, financial, environmental, or human, despite the capacity of renewable energy like the sun, wind, and water to provide many times as much energy as the entire world needs. This American control happens through wars. Without imperialism, the American capitalist system will not be upright, or by imposing economic systems that suit the interests of the United States and its companies using various means, most notably international organizations such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The United States wages military and economic wars on countries that have a huge stock of resources and countries that have huge global reserves, such as Iraq, Libya, Venezuela, Iran, and Bolivia, who are astonishingly suffering from electricity crisis. Lebanon is one of those countries, in addition to it being one of the countries in the region over which the Zionist entity makes sure to have leverage over, even if by force. Hence why, in its wars against Lebanon, Israel always targeted energy production plants, fuel tanks, and other energy requirements with the support and patronage of the Americans and the complicity of American assets in Lebanon, whose role in the July 2006 aggression was exposed by WikiLeaks.
Now we continue from Beirut with Dr. Tim Anderson, academic, author, and general coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance in Australia. Tim, Don donor institutions and state institutions or state donors as well. They place conditions on countries that are considered destructive to their economy, which is what happened in Lebanon and caused a deficit in the state budget as well as the Lebanese energy sector. And it is intended to happen again by the U.S. calling for the IMF to interfere in Lebanon. Thus, we're talking about the Lebanese economy that reached a complete collapse, and the production of mainly poor electricity was automatically affected in our country. All this is directly dictated by the United States of America. Would that be enough for Hezbollah to expand its now new project from getting fuel for the Lebanese people to actually completely solving the energy problem in Lebanon with the help of its allies in West Asia?
I think what you've said is going to happen gradually, step by step, and no doubt it's unpalatable to the big power that this means increased cooperation between Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. I don't think it's going to happen all at once. I think there's no need for other possible options in terms of sources of energy to be developed. But as we know, Hezbollah has a very good credit rating with Iran, a very good credit rating, and it's going to be a very competitive source of energy as it develops, as you've said, coming through Banyas and perhaps being refined there and shipped down into Lebanon. So it's an important first step, but let's see what other options are. It's good for Lebanon if there's a number of different options there. It would be a much more difficult thing for energy security if there were dependence on simply one source of energy.
Well, the issue here is, what if Hezbollah decides to go eco-friendly and get something that benefits Lebanon without actually further damaging our environment? With fuel ships, they went crazy. What would they do if we completely get rid of the use of oil or gas for electricity?
Well, if there are viable alternatives, I mean, that remains to be seen. I'm not sure to what extent that's the case now. There's extreme shortages, and in the short term, I think there's going to be take some time to wean people off the addiction of this diesel and benzene.
Well, the most dangerous thing is that some foreign parties will use their companies and they will take advantage of the current situation in Lebanon to market their desire to invest in new power plants, and their goal will only be to ensure that Lebanon depends on them, is always dependent on them, at least in the energy sector, to say the least. Yani. Thus, the United States is benefiting from the electricity crisis in Lebanon, just like in Latin America, for example, where the countries under U.S. sanctions and hegemony, they have great resources. They have a huge amount of resources, yet they are controlled by the U.S. Can a regional West Asian economic and infrastructure alliance be able to confront this form of neocolonialism? And if so, in what ways do you think it is possible? Not only in energy, what else?
Well, on the first part of your question, I think it's natural there's going to be some private initiatives to fill the gap, because there's a terrible need now. The country is very desperate, and there are huge queues all around for fuel. So I think those private initiatives are natural and necessary in some ways. The danger is there's going to be some inefficiency in developing projects which may not proceed. In terms of the second part of your question, I think it's absolutely essential that this neighbourly cooperation, the development of regional cooperation in infrastructure, energy, in commerce, in finance, in a range of things, develops much further. I think it's really the only medium-term to long-term solution for stability in the energy sector and many other sectors.
Well, Timon, it's wars against Lebanon. We have seen throughout history the Israeli entity targeting energy production facilities and fuel tanks and other infrastructure that are very important for any city in the world, with the support and sponsorship, obviously, of the Americans and the complicity of American assets inside of Lebanon, which was revealed by WikiLeaks after 2006. Will Israel truly just stay put, stay silent when all of this is happening? Will they abide by the new deterrence equation which was raised by Hezbollah to protect the Iranian fuel ships bound for Lebanon? Said Nasrallah was very obvious. He said, these ships are now Lebanese land. What do you think?
Well, we have to look at the current anxiety levels of Israelis. They are very concerned, particularly with the recent collapse of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. I think the collaborators of the U.S., particularly in their destabilization wars and proxy wars around the region, all looked at Kabul airport and feared it was them falling from those planes, basically. There was apparently a wave of emigration from the Kurdish separatists in the north of Syria. They were despairing that what's going to happen when the US pulls out of there. So the Israelis fear that. They're concerned about that, and I think that's why Bennett went recently to Washington to get some sort of assurances. The Israelis are always looking for some sorts of assurances that if something blows up, if Iran decides finally, for example, to respond to one of the many provocations, or if Syria decides to respond to one of the many provocations and attacks that are carried out, they want to be some sort of guarantee that the U.S. is going to back them up.
Well, American and Israeli wars in Lebanon, they completely destroyed the energy sector, but the war on Syria also harmed the Lebanese economy, given that this is the only land border that we have. Because the Zionist occupation, Lebanon has no other outlet except for Syria because of this occupation. Through Syria, we used to export to Iraq and to the other Persian Gulf countries and to Central Asia as well in certain products. But now, we can't even export anything, and we can't even import electricity or fuel from them. The borders were closed to any kind of interaction, and the relationship between the two countries almost became severe until last week, as we said, when the first official Lebanese delegation actually visited Damascus. We are witnessing a lot of change in the empire's behavior in the post-Afghanistan withdrawal era. Are the days of the empire numbered in West Asia, as its enemies would like to say, or is it just too early to be talking in this manner or in this tone?
I think there is a movement in that direction. There has been a discussion in Washington for some years about a strategic withdrawal from the region. You recall when Trump was campaigning 5 years ago, he was talking about withdrawing from Syria and Iraq. He made some moves, but was countermanded by other forces in the so-called deep state, same with Afghanistan. Now, for some time, the Saudis have been trying to get some sort of ceasefire in Yemen. So they know that they're losing. They've been losing for some years. And that affects the way they see the whole big picture.
Well, it does affect it, but there's something very important that we need to remind our audiences about: their presence in Iraq and how complicated it is for the Americans to actually withdraw from Iraq the same way they did in Afghanistan. But what would really push them to leave at this moment, and what would be the other option that would push them to stay?
Well, it's been enunciated by one of the officials at the end of the Trump administration, a man called McGregor, who said that he thought they should withdraw from the areas in which they were losing and consolidate in the areas which they considered their key interests, that is to say Israel, Jordan, some of the Gulf monarchies, for example. A strategic partial withdrawal from the region, because even though they can keep fighting a losing war to try and punish the people who have defeated them, there are some limits to that. And they've been losing in Syria for 6 years now, for example. So I think the occupations in Syria and Iraq are likely to collapse together.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, they're still paranoid about this. It doesn't mean they are not concerned. They're not going to try and undermine in other ways
mm-hmm.
Afghanistan, but also what's often spoken of as an Iranian land bridge. If you look at intelligence circles in Israel and the US, they talk about an Iranian land bridge as a great fear. That is to say, you have infrastructure networks from Iran across to the Mediterranean, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But that, of course, would be a great thing for the economic development of the region. This region is backward because it's been so divided, because it's been so smashed up, and those sorts of neighborly cooperation projects are the things that are really going to provide a step out of this terrible situation.
Well, it seems that we're going to have a very interesting end of 2021 and a beginning of a new 2022, where the presence of the Americans is very unstable in the region of West Asia. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tim Anderson, author, academic, and general coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance in Australia. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned for more from the Middle East next week.
In the limelight. Joe Manchin, the powerful West Virginia Democratic senator who chairs the Senate Energy Panel and earned $500,000 last year from coal production, is preparing to make President Biden's climate legislation in a way that tosses a lifeline to the fossil fuel industry. Despite urgent calls from scientists that countries need to quickly pivot away from coal, gas, and oil to avoid a climate catastrophe. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Coral Davenport. Coral Davenport writes about energy and environmental policy. The piece is titled, Manchin, with Close Ties to Fossil Fuels, Will Craft U.S. Climate Plan. Manchin, the powerful West Virginia Democratic senator who chairs the Senate Energy Panel and earned $500,000 last year from coal production, is preparing to make President Biden's climate legislation in a way that tosses a lifeline to the fossil fuel industry. Despite urgent calls from scientists that countries need to quickly pivot away from coal, gas, and oil to avoid a climate catastrophe. Joe Manchin has already emerged as a crucial up or down vote in a sharply divided Senate when it comes to President Biden's push to pass a $3.5 trillion budget bill that could reshape the nation's social welfare network. But President Biden also wants the bill to include an aggressive climate policy that would compel utilities to stop burning fossil fuels and switch to wind, solar, or nuclear energy, sources that do not emit the greenhouse gases that are heating the planet. As chairman of the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, Joe Manchin holds the pen and the gavel of the congressional panel with the authority to shape President Biden's ambitions. But Joe Manchin is also closely associated